This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. To me, one of the defining characteristics of my profession, academia, is cowardice. Professors who don't have tenure are afraid to say anything out of line for fear of losing their career. Professors who do have tenure are afraid of each other. They're also afraid of the students. Nearly everyone on a college campus lives in constant fear of being called a racist, or a sexist, or a rapist. Many political ideas that have been standard or even mainstream in the past are now considered to be part of a broader evil worldview that the United States did away with about 50 years ago. So anyone who puts forward an idea that runs counter to the dominant left liberal discourse on college campuses is considered to be a person of the evil past. And so there is a huge swath of ideas that have been considered in other times and places to be perfectly legitimate that are taboo. But there is one topic that is more taboo than any other. It's a topic that can't be raised in any context in American society, including in a college classroom. That topic is the relationship between sexuality and children. There is one professor, though, who is willing to break that taboo and is not only willing to discuss that relationship between children and sexuality, but also to show the tremendous damage that the taboo and the enforcement of the taboo has done to real people. Real people all around us. This is my interview with Professor of Sociology at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, New York, Emily Horowitz. So I'm in Brooklyn with Emily Horowitz, who is a professor at St. Francis College?
Yes.
In downtown Brooklyn, mm-hmm. who in internet parlance, just destroyed someone in a debate on, of all things, the sex offender registry. And Emily, you actually made the argument that the sex offender registry should not exist. Is that right?
Right. I mean, we've only had a registry since the mid-1990s, so it's not that radical to say it should not exist because we hadn't had one for
rational people who understand it, it's not radical, but for everyone else in the world, it is, right? But you won the debate. I think, wasn't it the most overwhelming victory in the Soho Forum history? I think
it was a good victory.
It was. I mean, what they said, not what you said.
Right,
they said that I think there was, they actually count people vote, right? Before and after where they stand on the issue. And you moved more people, I think, than anyone else in the history of that debate.
Thank you.
No, not thank you. It was just a fact. Am I right? That's just a fact.
Right.
Didn't Gene Epstein tell you that?
Yes, that's what they told me. Well, I mean, yes. I mean, I guess I would argue that if you actually think about it rationally, it's a very easy debate to win. There's no evidence that we should have one. It's purely emotional. So people listen to my argument.
And, but come on, you're being a little disingenuous.
Yes, I know people are very emotional about it. So
I mean, if you presented your argument exactly the way you did in that debate in most other venues in this country or this world, you would have been shouted down and maybe hanged by the neck in the town square.
Yes, it is a very it's an issue where we think with our hearts, not our minds, and it makes it really hard to talk about. So it was a really good opportunity to be able to have a debate like that with somebody who really supports the registry.
Right. So people who've listened to this show for a while will know something about this if they listened to the David Feige interview, which is from last year, one of my favorite interviews. And I discovered you after that fairly recently, actually. And I still don't quite we talked about this before we turned on the mics, but I still don't understand why I didn't know about you until recently. But because you've been doing this work for a long, long time, longer than almost anyone. And I've been interested in it for a while. And somehow it's my fault. I don't know. I failed. I didn't see you. I don't get it. Because you had a book in 2015 on this, and you've been making this argument for what? 15 years or something like that?
Yeah, about 15 years I've been working on this issue.
So for those who didn't listen to that episode, don't know your work, don't even know what the sex offender registry is, why don't we start there? Just explain what the hell this thing is.
So in the United States, there's almost 1 million people right now who are on our public sex offense registry. And these are people who were convicted of sex offenses. The majority of them, some states do list people on registries who are incarcerated, but that's a small number. So these people committed sex offenses. They served their time. They were on probation, parole. They did what they were supposed to do. And now they're on registries, many for the rest of their lives. So every time they apply for a job, a potential employer will see that they're on the registry. We have community notification laws. We have residency restrictions. They're restricted from where they can live. Neighbors are often informed that somebody on the registry is living near them. And unsurprisingly, their lives are really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And it runs counter to our whole notion of punishment. Punishment, you're supposed to serve your time and then have a second chance. And people who are convicted of sex offenses don't get that in our society.
So on a fairly regular basis, I would say at least once a month, I get an email from someone, I don't even know who it is, informing me, alerting me that a sex offender has just moved into my neighborhood.
Right. And supposedly you're getting this notification because you can protect yourself, you can protect your children, but community notification laws, not only do they not work, there is some evidence that they actually increase recidivism.
Oh, yeah?
Because people who are on registries, who are subject to these laws, there's some evidence they're more likely to reoffend. We know with all crimes, the best way to stop people from reoffending is to let them get housing, let them get jobs, let them reintegrate, let them have normal lives. And when you take that away from people, in the case of any crime, you make it far more difficult for them to have lives and more likely to be rearrested.
Why though? Do you know why? What's the causal connection there? Why would the sex offender registry regime basically is what it is.
Legal regime, yeah.
Why would that cause someone to be more likely to commit the crime again?
We know. So I'm a criminologist. Mm-hmm. I teach criminology. One of the things we know about reentry is that if you give people opportunities and a chance to rebuild their lives, they're far less likely to go back to prison.
Got it.
Across the board. And we've elevated sex offenses to this other level. We say, well, they're totally different. Then you won't know if an arsonist moves next door. You don't have to know if a murderer lives next door, but you have to know if somebody convicted of a sex offense lives next door to protect yourself. And there's no evidence for this. These laws were passed for emotional reasons. They make us feel better, but there is no evidence that having a registry is helpful.
Yeah, so give some examples. What are we actually talking about in real terms and concrete terms? How are people's lives specifically affected?
So I'll talk about somebody I recently interviewed. When he was in his early 30s, he committed a sex offense involving a 15-year-old.
Okay.
He went to prison for 7 years.
Okay.
He served his time. He's never reoffended. He's now 50. And if you look on the registry website where he lives, all you see a conviction for child molestation. His neighbors are constantly reminded through community notification that somebody, a 50-year-old man, has been convicted of child molestation, and they're afraid and they harass him. He can't get a job because in his state, they list the employer on the website. And employers say, well, you do have some qualifications. He's a computer programmer, but we're too fearful. We don't want our organization, our business on the sex offense registry website. He can't, his wife left him as a result of this incident, which is terrible. I mean, wrongdoing occurred. He did something wrong, but he went to prison. He went to prison for 7 years. He was on parole.
Let me outflank you on the radical left for a second here. Mm-hmm. How do we know he did something wrong?
Well, a 15-year-old went to her therapist and said she, you know, had sexual contact with him.
That was unwanted?
She shared it with her therapist in this case, and her therapist was a mandated reporter. And when he was questioned by police, he said, yes, I did that. I'm sorry.
Okay. So she felt like it was against her own interest, what had happened with him.
In that case, I'm not even sure of that. I think she was sharing it. But in many cases, you know, you can't consent. She's under the age of consent.
Do you know about Jerry Seinfeld?
I know who he is.
He's technically a sex offender, but he's not on the registry because he was never convicted of it. And this was known, well known during Seinfeld when he was a superstar in the 90s. It was well known at the time, but no one made much of it. He, at that time, was still in a relationship that began when his girlfriend was 17 and he was in his 30s.
Yes.
So if he had been convicted, which he could have been, he'd either be in prison or he'd be on the registry or both, right?
Correct.
Okay. Like,
and there's a lot of debate about age of consent and teenagers, and many people who are on the registry have adolescent victims, have young adult victims and adult victims. Mm-hmm. Many people are on the registry because of Romeo and Juliet offenses, where it's like a 19-year-old and a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old, and the parents go to the police. But there's a wide variety of people on the registry, but we don't need a registry. People who commit sex offenses and are punished have very, very low rates of recidivism. Even people who are evaluated and found to be the highest risk still have very low rates of recidivism. Something happens when you're punished. Maybe there's the shaming of being punished for a sex offense, but compared to other crimes, there's very, very low rates of recidivism. Mm. The Supreme Court has justified the registry on the grounds that recidivism rates for people convicted of sex offenses are frightening and high. And they've quoted that over and over and over. But we know that the Supreme Court was quoting a Psychology Today article that has now been debunked. It wasn't from a scholarly research article. It was an interview with a treatment provider who treated people who are convicted of sex offenses, who said, oh, well, we need this program because the rates of recidivism are frightening and high. Ira Ellman and Tara Ellman wrote this amazing article a few years ago where they dug into the Supreme Court. How do they keep quoting this? And they found it was mm-hmm. this Psychology Today article.
And you said there's a bunch of meta studies too, right?
Right. There's every meta analysis of the literature shows that recidivism rates for people convicted of sex offenses are very, very low. And you can be in favor of punishment mm-hmm. for any crime, but to have a registry, that's just government out of control. These are people who have served their time. We have a really harsh criminal justice system. If you are caught, looking at pictures of children that you shouldn't be looked at, you know, if you're charged with a child pornography crime, you can get a 3-digit sentence.
Oh yeah.
If you are caught—
3 digits, meaning more than 100 years in prison.
Over 100 years. That's right. Yeah. Even for non-contact.
For possession. Of child pornography, non-contact, meaning you never touched a child.
Right.
You can do 100 years in prison for that.
Right. Yes. I recently co-edited a book about people who are on the autism spectrum, who there's some evidence that people on the autism spectrum are getting caught up in these laws and are being convicted of child pornography for various reasons. And it's a very complicated issue, but it's very complicated to even study it. You can't really study it without people having these really emotional responses. But the research is totally clear. I mean, there are no studies that show the registry reduces recidivism.
Yeah.
Rates of sex offenses were declining before the registry was implemented in the mid 90s.
Yeah. I told you this before we turn on the mics, but the guy who played Puck in Glee, the mm-hmm. TV show, about 6 months ago, he was convicted of possession, just possession of child pornography on his computer. and was facing a minimum of 10 years. And he hanged himself by the neck from a tree in his front yard in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
This year. Yeah. So that's actually a fairly, he actually was going to get off relatively late, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much shame and stigma. And you're really considered a monster in our society once you're on this list. And the people on this list have served their time, and we can't say there's no justification for this list except pure vengeance, pure permanent punishment, naming and shaming and creating horrible monsters.
Here's how bad these sex offenders are. According to the culture, not to me. Murderers in prison think that they are superior to sex offenders.
That's right.
And I think this is right. At least I've heard this many times. It's mostly anecdotal, but seems right. Like that sex offenders in prisons do the worst. They're at the bottom of the hierarchy among the prisoners.
Right. They're often in protective custody.
In maximum security prisons with truly violent, horrible people, right?
Right. I mean, you're treated better if you kill a child than if you touched a child.
Oh, really?
I mean, well, essentially.
Yeah, right? I guess so. Yeah. That's an interesting question. I mean, yeah. I think so. I bet you that's right.
I mean, I feel like even just as somebody who works on this, I get a lot of really nice emails from people on the registry saying, thank you for speaking, you know, up for us, because so few people do, because it is really scary, because people think if you oppose the registry, you somehow don't believe that children should be protected.
Right.
And a lot of people who are on the registry, they can't advocate for themselves.
Emily, you don't have kids, do you?
I do. I have four children.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Are you serious?
Three girls. And when I think about the registry, you know, the registry isn't going to protect my daughters. I want my daughters to be able to speak up for themselves and say no. In the context of a lot of the Me Too revelations, you'll hear women being interviewed and they'll say like, well, why did you go to his room? Like, why did you go to his hotel room if you didn't want to? And they'll say, I just froze. Like, I didn't know what to do. I couldn't stop myself. I felt like I had to. Like, I want my daughters to learn how to say no and to have some agency. These laws aren't going to do anything. The majority of people that we're hearing about who are being outed and kind of this Me Too moment, none of them were on the registry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
95%.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, okay. I don't know. Do you think they should be?
I mean, I think, I think if people are convicted of an offense, they should serve their time. And I think we have a really harsh criminal justice system. People get really long sentences. We have a lot of things in place. I run a program for formerly incarcerated students, not people who are on the registry, mm-hmm. people who are convicted of drug and other offenses. And their lives are so difficult on parole and probation. They have to constantly go to treatment programs and go to parole officers. They have curfews. There's lots and lots of laws in place for anybody convicted of a crime, particularly for people convicted of sex offenses. We don't need more and more and more laws. Mm-hmm. And the registry is simply just another way to punish. It's the only justification is just vengeance.
I'm still reeling from the fact that you have four children. Even if you didn't make this argument about the sex offender registry, I'm just reeling from it. But wow, that makes it just even more kind of amazing what you're doing. Doesn't it?
Well, I think, you know, when you have children, like you want to, you know.
And daughters too.
That's, yeah.
That makes it really amazing. What's wrong with you?
Well, I mean, I know I feel
Are you
feel
Jewish?
Like
is that what's going
I
on
am
here? Are you one of those Jewesses who traffics
yes.
in
I'm the only non-Jewish
child sex
Horowitz. Yes, yes.
You're the only Gentile Horowitz?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, seriously, can you talk about that for a second? Like, has it informed your work? It must have made you think about it. I doubt it.
Well, like my friend Lenore Skenazy,
yeah.
who is of Free Range Kids, and now she started an organization called Let Grow. Sometimes I think as a parent, you're more aware of hysteria about sex offenses. Lenore, it's kind of a famous story. She let her 9-year-old ride the subway home alone. And then she wrote about it and she got massive blowback. Like, how did you know that your son wouldn't have been abducted and killed? And then she found that one of the biggest criticisms, what if somebody on the sex offense registry got him? What if somebody who was a sex offender got him? And so then she started looking at that, like, why are people accusing me of putting my child in a vulnerable position? And I was always very moved by her story, and she became a friend. Because when you have children, you're constantly accused of not watching them enough, of not making them safe enough. And a lot of it is tied to a hysteria about sex offenses. And the bottom line is, you know, over 90% of sex offenses are committed by people known to your child. They're not committed by strangers. They're not abducted in parks. They're harmed by non-strangers. And most people who commit sex offenses are first-time offenders. So this registry doesn't really do very much, but it has influenced how we raise our kids. And I feel like if you want to raise kids who have agency, if you want to raise kids who stand up for themselves, you have to let them take the subway themselves.
So now this sentence in your book means even more to me that I loved. Here's what you said about the sex offender laws. They are a strategy by which we unconsciously moderate our guilt about not doing enough for our children. And before I knew you had children, that was an awesome sentence to me. But now it's even more resonant. And I find that even more powerful, because now I understand why you wrote that and feel that, right? Because you were being shamed effectively.
Yeah.
Well, we all are being shamed right. All the time as parents, right?
Definitely, yeah. And working on this, how can you work on that? You have children.
And we shame ourselves mostly.
Right.
Constantly.
Right.
Isn't it constant?
All the time.
I feel guilt, 20 out of 24 hours. How about you?
About my children. At least 24 out of 24.
Yeah, about my son. I only have one. No, seriously. And it's so painful.
Yeah.
It's so painful.
Yes, it is. It is very painful.
Are you still with the father of those children? Because I'm divorced. So that makes it triply painful.
Yes, I had two with one person, uh-huh. and now I have two with my current husband. But right, when you're divorced, you always feel so much guilt.
Oh,
all
it's just
the time.
The worst. Especially, did you maintain custody?
I did, but
yeah. I mean, I did too, but it was always like the whole system, the culture, the courts, the lawyers, everybody was basically telling me from the beginning, and her too, well, she's the default parent, right? This is where, you know, so if you have to earn your custody as a man, I think there's a ton of sexism in the system,
right,
by the way.
Yeah.
I think it's the shame and the guilt is so powerful, and people who aren't parents won't get this fully, but those who are parents will totally know what we're talking about.
Right.
And when I saw that, saw you make that argument in your book, that was it for me. I think that's it. That makes so much sense, because I am in pain every day about this, and I can totally get, I mean, obviously it's never been my outlet, but I get why people would externalize that onto others, project that onto others.
Right.
I think we'll never be able to prove that, right?
Right.
But I think it's a persuasive theory as to why it's so powerful. Right? I mean.
No, I think so. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, here's the question: why in America, though, is it so powerful? Because do you know about other countries and laws about sex offenders and the culture around it?
Yeah, I mean, for example, in Australia, there was a study just released where they're evaluating. There is a lot of similar panic and hysteria there about child sex abuse. And the government just did a study saying, you know, should we have a public sex offense registry? The UK also was evaluating it, but they looked at the research and the evidence, and they basically said, there's no evidence that this works. It's really expensive.
Yes, right. How much does it cost the government to do this?
It's really hard to figure out, but
never thought about that.
I mean, there's a federal office. There's a federal national sex offense registry, and then each state has registries, and then people on the registry have to be monitored. They have to go to offices. You have to update your information all the time. I mean, it's a huge, huge bureaucratic
apparatus.
Apparatus, yes.
With lots of people who are employed at full salaries.
That's right. And for
not to mention the prisons, right? Which we have to operate. It's very expensive to have a prisoner
in
society.
That's right.
So what is it about English speaking people? Apparently English speaking people are the ones who are really the most hysterical about this. I don't know. I have no idea, but are we sure, by the way, that it's only in English speaking countries?
I think this level of panic? Well, those are the countries that I know that were evaluating a public sex offense registry. I believe, and I might be wrong, I believe South Korea might have one.
Interesting.
But no other country basically has a sex offense registry. In fact, the UK was going to extradite somebody to the United States. But because he was on the registry, they said our registry is a form of cruel and unusual punishment. And so they didn't, it was a violation of the UN human rights policies. It's viewed throughout the world as as really extreme.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the United Nations has weighed in on this.
Well, in the UK, they use the United Nations policy to justify why they weren't going to let him go back to the United States because they said he'd be subject to this law.
Yeah. What is it about English speaking people? It's the British inheritance somehow. I don't know. I mean, here's what it is. You want the answer? I got it.
Yes.
I just figured it out. You ready? It's easy. Puritanism.
It could be because it all has to do with sex.
Bingo.
It's a hysteria about sex.
Yep. The Puritans were English people.
Right.
There you go.
I mean, the way I first started working on this stuff is I was very interested. We talked about the amazing journalist, Debbie Nathan, who...
Before we turn on the mics. Yeah. Debbie Nathan is a tremendous journalist who wrote a book about the satanic panic in the 90s. I mean, the book came out in the 90s.
The book came out in the mid-90s.
At a time when it was not okay to be making this argument at all. It's not okay now, but then it was just craziness and evil to do this. And she did it really well and boldly. And she's really heroic in this.
She is. She was like the first journalist who wrote about it in the Village Voice.
First
about
anyone
suggesting,
who wrote about it in the way that she did. Yeah.
Right.
Making that argument. And the other thing that I love, this is one I want to talk about. One of the things I loved about her work on this was that she exposed, I didn't know this, that that leading feminists were leaders of the satanic panic.
Right.
That they were the ones calling for, you know, imprisoning all these people across the country who were heads of daycare centers, basically, right? Because they assumed it was true that they were raping children.
Right. That's right.
Gloria Steinem was one of the leaders of it, right?
She advocated for the families who believe their children have been sexually abused.
Yeah. And to me, we should be talking about that every single day. Like Gloria Steinem should be reminded of this every single day. And I'm not exactly sure. Well, maybe I don't know. Why do you think second wave feminists like Steinem took that position so strongly?
Well, carceral feminism in general is a very problematic.
Elizabeth Bernstein, she's awesome at Barnard. Yeah. She's an academic who wrote about this. She coined the term carceral feminism.
Oh, okay, good.
And she's awesome, and she's the one who coined that term.
Right. So my dissertation, I became interested in this in kind of an odd way. My dissertation was a study of a domestic violence court.
Okay.
And I wanted to study a domestic violence court because I thought, wow, this is such a great idea. Like, we're going to have a special court for people convicted of domestic violence, and we're going to give them extra punishment because they've done something so horrible. And as a graduate student, I read about domestic violence. It was the worst crime in the whole world. And as part of my research, I observed a specialized court part that only dealt with domestic violence. And I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do when I see one of these men who beat a woman? And I sat in that court for day after day. And all I saw poor and working class men getting extra sentences because they were charged with domestic violence crimes. And it looked like any other courtroom. And it was really sad because it was really clear to me that giving them longer prison sentences when they were already going to get pretty long prison sentences because it was a domestic violence crime was really problematic. And a lot of times the women would say, oh, I lied, I called the police, or they'd say, he's the sole breadwinner for our family, please don't do this, or please let him out to work. And the judge would say, no, it's not between you and him, it's between me and him. And it was such a weird form of feminism where the woman's like screaming and crying. And this was not infrequent. This was a very common scene. So I was very confused because I interviewed a lot of the feminist advocates who really believe that the answer to domestic violence was longer and longer prison terms. And it was really clear that domestic violence was about lots of other things. Plus in graduate school, I'd learned, domestic violence is rich, poor, everyone across the board, black, white. Well, the domestic violence court that I viewed, which was an entire city.
Which city?
I mean, it was Brooklyn. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
It's the county,
sure.
Kings
it's a city,
County.
Yeah.
It was all minorities, and it was all poor people. Mm-hmm. And one time somebody was a bus driver, was coming in, and like this woman that I'd gotten to know in the park, she said, oh, the next person, he has a job, he's a bus driver. Because nobody even had a job that came in there. And so it was so clear to me that it was about poverty and all these other things. And I grew really disillusioned with criminal justice.
So it was actually sub-working class people, right? People not working.
The lumpen proletariat.
The lumpen, the Marxists call, nicely, you know, charmingly call the lumpen proletariat. Yeah, I love those guys.
Yeah.
They live in this neighborhood too, by the way, that we're sitting in.
So then when I started learning about people who were convicted of sex offenses, I saw a similar theme that women who are motivated in very pure ways, they were against rape. They'd seen in the 50s and 60s, the criminal justice system not taking sex offenses seriously, not taking rape seriously, not believing women, completely going to the other side and doing this overcorrection and saying, oh, you know, now people who are convicted of these crimes should get more and more and more sentencing. But neither of these, more and more sentencing doesn't, you know, deal with sex offenses and why women are raped and why women are predominantly victims of sexual violence. I mean, almost everybody on the sex offense registry is male. The majority of victims are female. But sentencing, harsher and harsher sentencing, is not the answer.
Wow. I love this. This is amazing. That you saw this.
What?
Well, what do you mean? Yeah. You did,
no,
right?
Thank
you. So, no, and I mean, I've heard critiques that you're making before, right? But I've never ever talked or heard anyone talk about someone who's actually witnessed it, been in the courtrooms mm-hmm. and seen it. And it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
But you didn't answer my question.
Oh, what was the question? Sorry.
Why do you think second wave feminists took that position on sex offenses, satanic pants? Well, sex offenses.
Well, you even see with campus rape, right?
Yes.
You see.
Yes, you do.
Not only is an expulsion enough, not only is, you know, being kicked out of the campus enough, they should be going to prison. And there's some feminists who say, we want more criminal justice involvement. We want less due process. We want, you know, more and more and more punishment. And again, that is completely the wrong way to go.
I'm actually going to do something that's very strange. I'm going to slightly defend second wave feminists. Strange for me. On campuses anyway, what I see and hear most often from those people is, you know, marching and yelling and demanding action against all the sex offenders on campus. But when asked as to what should really be done to them, they always stop short at putting them in prison. You know, because that's always the question, right? Is like, okay, so if that thing is a crime, is rape, what you said, you know, mm-hmm. then that means, doesn't it, that he should go to prison for a very, very long time?
Well, I guess I could argue.
And then then they would blanch and say, well, maybe not. And
because these are the same people who are against mass incarceration, and feminists have been.
I wonder.
Very outspoken.
I just wonder if that's what the contradiction that happens. I don't know.
Right. And it is like a tension within there's like a prison abolition movement. There's mm-hmm. all these movements against mass incarceration, but people convicted of sex offenses are often kind of orphaned.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to grapple with that because victims' rights people, the victims' rights movement has a huge amount of power. And I would say initially, I think feminists were, you know, pro-incarceration as an effort to get recognized. Emily Yaffe, like, she wrote this great piece called The Campus Rape Overcorrection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like nobody cared about campus rape, and now everybody cares too much about campus rape, right? And so in the 50s and 60s, you had police officers saying, well, what were you wearing? If you went to his apartment, it's not rape. You can't rape your wife, blah, blah, blah. And so feminists were genuinely wanted police officers to take rape seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But then one of the things I argue in my dissertation is when they started developing organizations and getting a lot of state and federal money in order to work with the state and to work with the courts, you had to, you know, accept the outcomes of the state and the court, which is punishment.
Professor Horowitz, I just had a realization about my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know who one of the first carceral feminists was?
Who?
My mother.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I just remember that she told me that she was a left activist, socialist, right, revolutionary in Berkeley in the 60s and 70s, but she was also a feminist. And she said that she began her activism as a feminist by calling for basically the police to crack down on rapists. And when she told me that at the time, which was many, many years ago, I thought, oh, awesome, mom. Good for you.
Right. And but maybe, that's a reaction to
and in some ways,
police
I'm sure,
doing nothing. And saying, yeah, yeah, what yeah. were you wearing? And you had a beer. And,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah. So, I'm still a little bit, I'm not totally sure where I am on that. Do you know Vicky Law, Victoria Law?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
She spoke to my class.
Okay. Oh, really? Yeah. So I love her argument about this and the organization, Insight. That's the name of her organization, or at least it used to be. And I forget the head of that, but Insight is an organization of mostly women, I think, women of color. In fact, it's women of color who, and one of the things they've argued is that domestic violence, rape, et cetera, should be treated sort of communally rather mm-hmm. than through the state.
Right. Well, I'm aware there's something called circles with support and accountability but if you take the example of Brock Turner, right? Now you look up Brock Turner.
The guy who was Stanford. Convicted of raping a woman in Palo Alto or Stanford?
Yes, he was at Stanford. And
he was an athlete, right?
And he was a student athlete. Yeah,
and he got relatively light sentence, right? Or no sentence, or what was it?
So here's how messed up we are as a culture. And I think that case really crystallizes this tension for me. So Brock Turner is convicted of raping an unconscious woman while they're both under the influence of lots of alcohol. Mm-hmm. She's passed out. The judge gives him 3 months in jail and then 3 years of probation and then life on the sex offense registry. And everybody just said, oh my gosh, he only got 3 months in jail. We've got to get rid of this judge. Hmm. This judge needs to be recalled because this is too light a sentence. This is a terrible thing. I mean, life on the sex offense registry is not a terrible thing. Is a terrible
yes,
thing.
It is.
Is not a light yes. sentence. Life yes. on the sex offense right. registry is a life sentence. Being kicked out of Stanford
you know
is
what?
A punishment. 3 months in jail is punishment. 3 years on parole is punishment.
You know what? I just realized, again, you gave me another realization. That was what, 4 years ago about? I remember, I didn't even notice that he got, I don't think it was reported.
It wasn't
was
really reported.
They just put on the registry.
Just kept saying, and there was this huge mobilization. A
right.
feminist Stanford
huge.
Professor, Michelle Dauber, made it yeah. her goal to get this judge recalled. Now this judge, the AP did a study. In 100% of the cases, the judge took the recommendation of probation. In this case, it wasn't because they were good old boys at Stanford, as the press was initially reported, and he had all this sympathy for a white privileged kid. He took the recommendation of probation, who said, 3 months is what they recommend, low likelihood of reoffense, blah, blah, blah. And the judge, they couldn't find any evidence of racial disparities. The AP, which is not a lefty radical organization,
no.
analyzed all of his rulings. Yet there was this groundswell, millions and millions of people signed petitions.
Oh, yeah.
And he was recalled. It was the first recall in California in decades.
Oh, I didn't
the judge
know he
was recalled.
Wow.
Okay. And to me, all that's the impact is going to be judges are going to be really, really frightened moving forward to give anybody compassion.
Yeah.
I mean, this kid's life is completely destroyed. I don't know how you can say that's a light sentence. It's
no.
not a light sentence, but we're so conditioned. We think he should have gotten 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was left feminists who are arguing this. It wasn't from the right.
I know.
In fact, now you look in textbooks, there's a picture of this kid under rape.
Okay. So for you, it's an overcorrection.
It's an overcorrection.
Which, at least in part, is reasonable, because it's true that, as far as I know, police before the 1970s, before my mother started arguing mm-hmm. this and other feminists at the time, as far as I know, I haven't actually seen proof of this, but I've just always assumed they were telling the truth about this, that police generally ignored rape claims by women.
Right. And the anti-rape movement was really effective. I think within 5 years of the anti-rape movement really being organized, they got every police department in the country had training and how to deal with rape victims. And before, none had any training. Hospitals have rape kits. They didn't, this was a result of feminist organizing.
Right.
There were no battered women shelters. That was also a result of feminist organizing.
I guess I'm just thinking through this now. So on a certain level, it's reasonable that they would do that because it's such a gross, at least misapplication, right? Or of the law. It's clearly unequal treatment under the law. However, the fact that that generation of activists and feminists reached first for the state to save them, to help them, to solve this, I think needs to be challenged. That's a problem for me.
Well, and I think there was radical feminists and there were liberal feminists, mm-hmm. and the liberal feminist organization thrived because they merged with the state and they started getting mm-hmm. state funding. The radical feminists who did want to, you know, have consciousness raising and work outside of the police and were anti-police and didn't want the police to be
even involved. Then in the 60s and 70s,
yeah, there were. Judith Levine, who's a great journalist, has written extensively about
right.
this.
She's I'm going to have to go ask my mother. I'm going to see her soon. No, I'm serious. I'm going to ask her, Mom, were you a radical or a liberal on this? Because she was a Trotskyist socialist.
Oh, okay.
I mean, she was a radical in everything else. I wonder, but she's always had liberal tendencies, so I wouldn't be surprised if she took the bad.
But how do you survive without like having, you know, 501c3 status and leaders and all this? And to get state money, you have to have proposals that correlate. I mean,
you don't think it's instrumentalist in that way, do you? I mean, I think it's cultural.
No, but I think that's why people always say like the movements of the 60s, feminism was one of the successful movements. And one of the reasons why they say it was one of the successful movements is because it became institutionalized.
Exactly.
And to be institutionalized, you have to get money from philanthropies and government and figure out some way to survive.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/Russell. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the very first day. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest rated hiring site in America. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Russell. That's two S's and two L's. That's ZipRecruiter.com/RUSSELL. ZipRecruiter.com/Russell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, so reaching for the state, right, as a strategy to correct what's called injustice, mm-hmm. right? To me, it is problematic in a couple of ways. One is the one we've been talking about, which is that it does tremendous damage to human beings, mostly in this case, men, mm-hmm. okay, who tend to get not a lot of sympathy from second wave feminists. Okay, fine. And I'm a man and I relate to these guys and I feel awful about this and it's horrible. And if it were that alone, I would be for abolishing the sex offender registry. There's another effect that, believe it or not, as bad as a 100-year sentence for possession of child pornography is, in some ways, I think is even more important and more reactionary, patriarchal, and fundamentally conservative, which is that it takes agency away from women. And also, I think, teenagers in this case, right, often, right? Because the state becomes the protector, mm-hmm. and it's saying that women can't take care of themselves. Now, it is true that men, generally speaking, are physically stronger than women, and that's sort of the base fact that underlies that argument against what I'm saying here, right? Well, mm-hmm. women need a stronger protector like the state with muscle and guns to protect us from these men who are physically stronger than us. How do you come back to that?
Well, I mean, the data shows, right, that most people convicted of sex offenses are men and most victims are women, period. Mm-hmm. And my students, though, they always say, well, like, if you look at domestic violence statistics, it's even more disproportionate. And they will always say, they'll get into like, they actually get very excited about this. Well, women hit men, but men are too embarrassed to call the police. Like, they'll hit you all the time and the police won't believe you.
Pause for a second.
Yes.
So my
students get really offended.
And your students are not like a lot of college students. They are
St. Francis. First generation
working class, New York, Queens, Brooklyn kids, right?
Right. And I'll show them the data on domestic violence arrests and
so
how it's
they
primarily
actually know this stuff firsthand, probably.
Right. And then
unlike the kids in the Ivy Leagues.
That's probably
that's your
true
argument.
Right. That
you're,
is true.
You're saying
that
it's largely true a working class phenomenon. The people you witnessed in that
right,
courtroom
that's right
are related to those kids in your classrooms.
Right. That's right.
Right? Exactly. So they've seen it.
Right. And so they get really offended.
And they're saying,
and they'll also say that men are embarrassed, they won't be taken seriously, that it's not possibly true that 98% of domestic abusers are male. And I'll say, well, this is the data. This isn't my opinion, but they'll still argue with me.
Oh, so
I'll just show them the statistics that it's almost all men who are arrested for domestic violence crimes.
Tell me about the statistic. No, and that's undoubtedly true.
Yeah.
But do you?
And same thing with sex offenses.
Right. But do you think that the statistics are true in this way?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are arrest statistics.
No. There's no disputing that.
Right.
That most are arrested.
Right.
But,
so they'll say those statistics are wrong because they don't reflect the reality women often hit men and men don't want to call the police.
Right.
So then I'll say, well, look at ER statistics.
Okay.
If you look at ER statistics, according to ER data, the majority of victims are female and the majority of perpetrators are male. But, you know.
So that means?
I guess they're not as seriously injured, but most domestic violence is not going to go through the ER.
Does not result in serious injuries. The vast majority.
But if you look at, so they'll say, you know, women often hit men, but men would just never call. Even if they were, they'll say, even if they were injured enough to go to the ER, they would not go because it's so humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
But women hit men all the time, or women hit first and men are hitting back in self-defense. And, and they always say that for years and years. I've been teaching like 13 years and they've been saying that every time they look at these statistics, every class.
Yeah.
They get really offended by that data.
So I was hit.
Oh, by a woman?
By a girlfriend.
Oh.
Yeah. It's interesting because she was working class too. She was like the only girlfriend I've had or wife who was, you could call working class in any way.
Right.
And I don't know, but yeah.
But you didn't call the police?
She hit me hard and when I was asleep.
Oh.
Yeah.
She like went through your phone or something?
I was comforting my son in his bed and she was very jealous of him.
Oh.
Needless to say, we're no longer together, but.
Talk about guilt.
I should have broken up with her right then, but I didn't. And I sure didn't call the cops, but someone else called the cops, not her. She didn't ever call the cops on me, but I never hit her. I never did anything to her like that, but the neighbors did because they heard something.
Yeah.
And this is when I found out another part of this regime. The cops show up, four cops, LAPD, show up my door. And I said, what are you doing here? And they said, we need to come in. We got a report of possible domestic violence in this house. I said, what are you talking about? My girlfriend hit me. I had kicked a box in my backyard during this. I think there was a fight earlier that night or something. And I'm sure it made a lot of noise and the neighbors heard that. I've assumed that's what they were responding to. And I said, yeah, it didn't happen. And they said, well, we need to enter the premises anyway. And I said, no, what are you talking about? Where's your warrant? And they said, we don't need a warrant for this. I said, what on earth are you talking about? Have you not read the Constitution? And they said, no. You know, eventually I demanded that I speak to one of their supervisors. So they actually got whatever the lieutenant or captain in the precinct to come to my house. And I'm sitting there in handcuffs, by the way, not sitting, I'm standing in my front yard in handcuffs with four cops because I refused to move, get out of their way to let them into my house. So they handcuffed me and put me in the front yard and waited. I waited for this captain to come and talk to me. He said, oh yeah, the judges recently have ruled that if anybody reports the possibility of domestic violence, we are obligated by law to enter the premises and search it, which is what they did. And they found my girlfriend who was completely untouched. And she said, yeah, nothing happened. Although something did happen, but not from me. And then they finally left and they complimented me on my collection of books. And they said, oh, do you read a lot? I said, yeah, I'm a professor. And they were like, whoa, this doesn't happen very often. But anyway, so it's an incredibly totalitarian regime.
Yes, it's pretty scary.
The idea that you could call the cops and say, oh, at 43 McGinnis Boulevard, which is near where we are, you know, oh, I heard something that sounds a lot like a guy hitting a girl. You will get cops to go into that place. If you ever want to fuck someone's life up, you can do that so easily now, right?
Yeah, and you can do it with CPS. You can call CPS anonymously on anybody and you can say they're mistreating their children and CPS will go and investigate. So all of this is driven, like CPS that's driven by
child protective services. Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's driven by a desire to protect children, right? Sex offense laws are driven by a desire to protect children. Domestic violence laws are driven by a genuine desire to—
Wait a minute. I'm not sure about that. What? You think so? It's driven by a desire to protect children. Do you think?
I mean, the rhetoric around it.
Yeah, no, for sure. But like, what's— I mean, this is all speculative.
I think people who support registries, for instance, they'll say, "Well, you don't care about children. Are you pro child sex abuse?" And you know, it's very hard to say. I oppose sexual wrongdoing. I think accountability is really important, but I oppose excessive draconian punishment for any crime.
Yeah.
And it's really a question of how you view the world. I mean, do you view the world as a place where people should be treated fairly and with justice and have second chances? Or do you think like one slip up and you're up?
But I quoted you. You have an argument about this, which is that they're acting out their guilt about their own parenting.
Right.
That's what it's about.
Yeah. That's
and true, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I can't prove it, but instead of really being about protecting children, I think it's about projecting their own stuff, their own guilt about how they treat their own children.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Definitely Debbie Nathan has articulated this really beautifully. In the 80s and 90s, the allegations against daycare workers were really about guilt because women were working at higher rates. And so it was some way to, you know, punish working mothers who are putting their kids in daycare, putting them at risk. And I mean, she has a more complicated argument. That was part of it, though.
Yeah.
You're such a terrible mother. You're not home with your children. And now they're, you know, being raped and put into satanic tunnels and massacring elephants and doing all these things. And people believed it. And why did they believe it? Because of guilt and fear about their own parenting and their own kids.
And it happened in tandem with the recovered memory
thing. Right, that was part of it.
And by the way, God, I'm making lots of connections with you. This is really awesome for me. I hope it's good for you. My girlfriend's mother was part of that. She had a recovered memory thing where she accused her father of serially raping her throughout her childhood. And, you know, I don't know, within the family, there was at least some skepticism about this. You know, who knows, right? But knowing her mother, I tend to be skeptical too. But, you know, that was a thing where there were lots and lots of people, mostly women, but not entirely, a lot of men too, by the way, who well into their adulthood, quote, realized or quote, remembered that they had been raped or abused by their parents, one of their parents when they were children, right?
Right. And that was also a weird offshoot of kind of feminist efforts to get child sexual abuse taken seriously.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, women who would exhibit symptoms would go to therapists and they'd say, maybe you were sexually abused and you're not dealing with it. And then it became any kind of neuroses you're repressing. If you don't remember being sexually abused, you actually were because you're not, you repress it if it happened. And there was a weird trend in therapy that was closely related to feminist efforts to get child sexual abuse taken seriously because nobody cared about child sexual abuse. And all of a sudden it's saying, not only do we care about it, but it happens far more frequently. And then recovered memory kind of seeped into this.
The history of this, I believe, starts in the 50s, right? The people began caring about molesters in the 50s, right? The molester panic.
Right. There's been, there's a really good book, I can't remember who wrote it right now, but there's a very good book about the history of sex panics.
Yeah.
Hoover.
No, but
in the 30s, there was a sex panic. And then in the 50s,
For children, it was the 50s.
Yeah. I mean, he writes about, Philip Jenkins, it's called Moral Panic, Changing Conceptions of the Child Molester in like American Culture. And he writes about how at times we joke about Chester the molester, who is this harmless kind of loser who couldn't relate to adults, hanging out at the park with kids.
For our younger audience, that's the cartoon and Hustler, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, you know, with a raincoat, just, you know, and then now it's the predator who's the embodiment of all evil and not just a harmless loser, but actually somebody who's going to go and take your child and chop them up and murder them. And there's waves of sex panic. And there's been a lot of people who've written a lot of really good stuff about this.
The recovered memory thing though is still fascinating to me. And it is for a personal reason. I don't think I can divulge here, but let me ask you this. How old are your kids?
7, 9, 18, and 20.
Oh my gosh. Okay, good. So perfect. So have they ever accused you of having done anything to them that you are very clear did not happen? I mean, it could be minor too. Have they made up stuff that you're pretty sure didn't happen?
They always, like, my daughter one time, I was late picking her up from an after school program, and she's 20, and she'll say, "I was crying, remember that?" And she always laughs because I'll just buy her anything she wants and do anything for her whenever she reminds me of that moment, how I was late. And it was like the first week of kindergarten, and
And it didn't happen.
It happened.
Or she exaggerated.
Yeah, she exaggerates the... They will change stories to make it like I'm more guilty than I actually was.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Because I mean, I have zero personal experience with this, but I've heard that there are parents out there whose children do accuse them of things that definitely didn't happen. I'm just saying I've heard this.
Yes.
The grapevine. I mean, I have no firsthand knowledge, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was a whole there's a lot There was an organization called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which was a lot of parents who were, they say they were falsely accused of child sexual abuse by their kids, and all their kids had been part of recovered memory therapy, and they all said it didn't happen.
Yeah. And I don't mean just, you know, I'm not talking about just accusations of rape or violence, but, you know, kids often do this.
They remember when you ate my birthday cake.
Exactly. Yeah. They exaggerate things to make you look better, to make you look worse, to get back at you for whatever reason, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Pretty
I can
common.
That.
I've heard.
Yes.
From others. Yes. So you're reading your notes a lot?
I'm just looking.
Which is all good.
Sure
here's all I have to say about it. I'm just curious what we haven't talked about that you want to talk about.
Yeah, so I was just, you know, I came here hoping to raise more awareness about the registry because I think the number is, there's 900,000 plus people on it now. It goes up every year. Nobody ever goes off of it. And really, you know, it'd be good if people understood what it's like to be on the registry and what it's like. I mean, we have them in all 50 states, your photograph, your height, your weight, your license plate, and it's there forever. And then sometimes these private companies take the information. So it's also on Home Facts and all these other weird sites. So it's the first thing people see when they look you up, which is what you do. You can't be part of social media. There's a case I'm working on, a guy, he got very, very drunk. And he and his friend went into a sorority, and his friend, and there was a trial. So I've read the transcript of this case. Facts of the case are the friend sort of touched the girl. He was standing there laughing. The girl woke up, screamed, they ran out. He went to trial because he felt he shouldn't be prosecuted for rape because he went to trial. He wound up, it's an Oregon case. And he wound up getting, I think, 7 or 8 years in prison. Now he's on the registry for life. He's single. He was like in his early 20s, mid 20s when he went to prison for this. And he can't be on any social media sites, forget Facebook, but he can't date. He can't even use Instagram, which he liked to put photos up of his dog. He's completely isolated. He can't meet anybody through the internet. Most of the people on the registry can't. So they're very hopeless. It's very lonely. And they all, many of, you know, I don't, it's hard to quantify it, but most of them have jobs that are kind of in, you know, like the underground economy. One person that reached out to me recently, he has a PhD from a top school in computer science. He gets interviews at really big tech firms, but then they find out he's on the registry and he's a computer programmer. So he like wouldn't be around children. He was convicted in that case, the computer programmer was convicted when he was 20. Even if he works remotely from home, they're too frightened to hire him. Even as a consultant, it's too risky. So he's working in a coffee shop and he's an amazing computer programmer, very remorseful. He was very young when he committed his offense.
1 million people with stories like that.
Yeah.
1 million people.
Right.
And if you don't believe us, if you're listening and don't believe us, just check it out.
You can look it up.
The stories are just endless of like this. You can see the film, David Feige's film, which is called Untouchable.
Yeah. It's a great film.
Which has, I think it focuses on four or five stories, right? Mm-hmm. And each one is just, and they range, you know, tremendously. One is a Romeo and Juliet story, which, you know, she was very young and he was very young. And she's like this pretty blonde woman who lives in the South.
Oh, right. She's a female offender.
Yeah. And she, yeah, like, I think when she was 19 or something, when she was a teenager, she had sex with a underage teenager.
She was like 19. He was 16.
Yeah. And it was totally consensual. And of course he was into it. And, but she's on the
registry.
She's on the registry forever.
And she has kids.
Can't get jobs.
In her state, they now banned people on the registry from parks. So she can't take her children to parks. And she has like a 5 and a 7 year old or something.
And the whole, like, what is it? The entire downtown area of Miami, Florida is barred to them, right?
Right. So for a while, there was a famous story of people, homeless sex of people convicted of sex offenses in Florida living under a bridge because there was no residential housing in Miami. Yep. And they were living in a parking lot. And now they've been thrown out of the parking lot. They're banned from hurricane shelters. In Michigan, there's a story I'll never forget of a guy who froze to death. He was banned from homeless shelters and he was on the registry. A lot of sheriffs like to go on like local news stations and say, we have a hurricane, but don't think about coming to our hurricane shelters if you're on the registry to show how tough they are.
It's positively medieval.
Right. As if like somebody who's convicted of one of these offenses is going to wait for a hurricane to go to a shelter to find. It's so absurd. But people support these laws because it's really hard to think about them rationally. We're thinking with our hearts, not our mind. Yeah. And we're not looking at recidivism rates. We're not looking at them as human beings. We've really created like monsters. It's banishment. Mm-hmm. Social death is a really good term.
It sure
is. They really... and when you talk to people on the registry, that's what it's like.
Yeah. Yeah. There are very few of the guy who jumps out of the bushes and puts the knife to the woman's neck and forces her to have sex. I mean,
if you're caught and prosecuted for that, you're going to get a really, really long sentence.
Just for that. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, just exactly. For that. So yes, we have a lot of
checks
in place.
We do plenty to rapists. Yes.
Yes.
yeah. So here's an interesting thing. You know, the discourse around it, certainly the laws, are associated with, sound like, the good old Reagan Republican tough on crime people, right?
Right.
But it's almost universal, right? It's pan-partisan. It's,
right.
It's feminists, it's conservatives, it's progressives, it's Republicans, it's everybody. It's probably Trump people, it's probably Obama people, it's probably socialists.
Right, Clinton passed Megan's Law.
That's
and he
right.
He said, we are circling the wagons for That's our children right. today. And he went to Yale Law School, right? I mean, he was like a legal scholar.
What was Megan's Law?
Just so Megan's Law was the first federal public sex offense registry in 1996, which created it like
it
in all 50
it.
States.
It's the yeah. origin of this.
Well, 1994 was the Wetterling Act, but essentially 96, Megan's Law, named after a child who was abducted and murdered by a stranger.
It's a Democratic Party creation.
I think it had, I don't think anybody opposed it. So
well, true.
I think it's
bipartisan. That's true. But, but they certainly pushed it
but
and initiated
Clinton,
it.
Clinton, somebody asked him at some point, like, what about, you know, due process and constitutional rights, something, you know, about these are people who've served their time. And he said, when it comes to children, none of that matters, you know? Mm-hmm. And so who's going to argue with that? Who wants to be the guy saying, wait, what about?
Right. You know, I mean, he was tough on crime in every way though. I mean, he was the guy behind all this mass incarceration stuff pretty much in the 90s, beginning in the 90s. So it was completely consistent with his ideology.
Right.
But
he signed it with parents yeah. near him and it's had really devastating effects. So, but the rhetoric he used was, we love children. You know, justice doesn't matter when it comes to children.
So a lot of people on the real left, like the socialist left, would say, oh, well, Clinton wasn't really a liberal anyway. He was a neoliberal, which is a decent argument. But mm-hmm. but I want to say, you know, as we know, like a lot of people who are clearly on the left, certainly feminists, but even others, I would imagine, well, we know are also on board with this.
Right.
And there's a contradiction. I would love to ask all the people who are opposed to mass incarceration passionately, which mm-hmm. is a lot of people now, and they're all on the left, how they feel about this. Have you ever right. done that? Have you ever?
Well, there's people like Erica Miners, who's a Chicago-based scholar, who's written a lot about how the anti-mass incarceration prison abolition movement has to incorporate people convicted of sex offenses. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're pretty, I think it's everybody's very fearful to take this on. Mm-hmm. But you definitely see with like Title IX and campus rape, you know, that's really calling for more. It's not calling for more justice. It's calling for more punishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's from the left.
Right. So you live in New York City. You're a professor of sociology. Mm-hmm. You must be around lefties all the time. And I'm wondering how it goes, how it goes between you and them when you bring this up or when it comes up.
Yeah. I mean, definitely people who know me, I try to, you know, like my colleagues, they've heard me talk about this. They're familiar with my book. I mean, I do feel like this argument makes sense. In fact, when I was preparing for that debate, I was thinking, well, I should kind of think about what she's going to say. But there's really no argument for it, except we hate those disgusting people. Yeah. There is no argument that makes any sense in favor of it.
Right.
So I feel like once you educate people about it and talk about it, it's really hard to... I mean, it's very hard to argue in favor of the registry.
I agree with you. There's no, at least right now, there's no way to make an argument the way that we think about arguments.
Right.
On that side, you can sure as hell make a powerful moral claim, though, which is not an argument, but it's just that, you know, if we all agree that those people are evil, then that's it.
Right.
And apparently a lot of us do think that they are evil, and therefore we put them not in the prison, we put them underneath the prison.
Right. But then when you like kind of say, well, okay, who are those people? Well, there's tons of different people who are caught up in these laws. Mm-hmm. There isn't one. You're thinking of your people who, the stranger abductor who, you know, rapes and murders a child, that's almost non-existent on the registry. So who are you talking about? So yeah, if you actually have a serious conversation with somebody, it's pretty hard, I think, to argue in favor of it. So people I know, they'll say, oh, you know, they will say, like, couldn't you work on something else? This is kind of creepy. Like, it's enough. Or you wrote your book. Like, it's enough. Move on. Because it is, you know.
Do they actually say creepy?
Yeah. Like, I had a friend and I said, oh, I'm going to give you my book. And he said, it kind of gives me the willies. I don't want it on my bookshelf, you know, because it's like, it makes people uncomfortable, you know. Mm-hmm. People say there's enough problems in the world. Why do you have to defend the rights? The whole world's falling apart. Why did you have to, is this the hill you want to die on? People convicted of sex offenses. But at the same time, I feel like it's the worst people, the people that have it the worst, the people who are the most banished and the most hurt that you kind of have to defend.
Yeah.
I mean, if you care about humanity.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you a question that I asked earlier in the interview again. And you gave me an answer, which was a really good one, but I'm going to ask again because I think there might be some more answers, which is, why are you doing this? And the answer you gave was that great one about doing your dissertation. You started off with a sort of typical feminist line about this, and you saw these men in the courts and that whole thing, right? And that's great, but you've stuck with it for a very long time. Against all the odds, against just everyone being against you, right? Even in your world, right? Even in New York City, even in the left liberal world of academia, you know, virtually everyone is against you.
Even in my family, there's people who are like, it's enough. Yeah.
Oh yeah. What do your daughters think?
Yeah. I mean, they're like, definitely sometimes like, mom, you know, yeah.
What do you mean?
They feel like it's enough already. Like, why did you pick this? Can't you do something else? You know, why do you have to defend those people, you know? So, and even though they've been kind of around this for a long time and they're aware of the injustice, I think they know people are really critical and they don't want to say that it's my mom, you know, working on this stuff.
So what do you say to them? Why do you do it, mom?
I say what I said to you. You have to, you know, defend those who can't defend themselves. And this is really a population that cannot defend themselves. I mean, they literally are very limited on social media. People, the minute, you know, it comes out, you're on the sex offense registry, people will shut down and not listen. So at least I have, you know, a little bit, I am a sociologist, I have this nice teaching job. So I am in a position where I can do something. A lot of people who advocate are mothers, wives, children of people on the registry, but in a way, you know, it's harder because they have,
An iron in the fire?
An iron in the fire, yeah. And so I don't.
Right.
And so I feel like, you know, somewhat obliged at this point. And I mean, the number's growing. It's not a problem that's been resolved. And there's lots more to say about it.
Yeah.
And I even feel like now, politically, it seems like people are, the hysteria in some ways is gearing up because you see this with social media accusing people of hurting children sexually is a really good way to smear them and ruin them. And it's really important to speak out. I mean, you see both on the left and the right, that being a very popular way to.
Tell me if I'm right about this. Your analysis is, I think, primarily a class analysis.
I don't know about that. Maybe you can tell me.
Or maybe the passion is primarily about class. And this is not a criticism. Mm-hmm. I love this about your argument. It's actually, I don't hear it that much among those of us doing this work. And it's good because it really appeals in a genuine, true way, I think, to that portion of the left that cares about class mm-hmm. and about what people on the left call inequality, which is a word that occurs in your book a lot. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Because you, I mean,
yeah,
that's what
I mean,
really
I definitely think that people will be really passionate about registries and they'll want to hunt down. I mean, people who are in registries are often subject to vigilante violence and other just low level forms of harassment all the time. I've probably interviewed a couple of hundred people now who are on the registry, and people throw things at their homes, they harass them, they fight so they can't attend events at their children's schools. People are very passionate about that, but they're not really passionate about other policies that might help children.
Right.
And this is, you know, as expensive as this is, it's much easier to just say, lock up those people. That shows that I care about children than really figuring out what children need and what is good for children.
Right. So let me ask a little bit of a provocative question. Mm-hmm. Do you, and if this pisses you off, just tell me and we'll move on. Mm-hmm. Do you think you would be as passionate about it if the class dynamics of sex offender law is were reversed, that it was mostly wealthy people doing
it?
Or being accused of it or being convicted of it?
I don't think so, because definitely it is.
Or you wouldn't be as passionate, or you would be as passionate about it?
What compels me about it is monster making and stigma and hysteria and panic.
Okay.
But yeah, that's not. I think if it were like a 1% problem, you know, if it was only like, you know, extraordinarily wealthy people with power, maybe it would be less interesting to me. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, definitely most of the people I've met who are involved with the criminal justice system in any way are working class.
Yeah.
I mean,
So even if you completely acknowledge that, you know, mm-hmm. or own that, doesn't mean anything bad about you or what you're doing, because all of us come to this with our own thing, right? Our
yeah.
own reason for being passionate about it. And for me, class didn't really, I mean, it definitely occurred to me, it was obvious that most people were working class or poor who were caught up in this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I cared about that, but mm-hmm. not primarily. Primarily for me, it's about Puritanism, mm-hmm. sexual Puritanism in particular. It's about the state power. It's about incarceration. It's about prisons and cops and guns mm-hmm. and all that state violence, right, against people.
Yeah.
Those are the things that I'm most passionate about. And when those things are joined together, when the state is crushing people for basically being sexual,
right,
that's where I get really fired up and will always be fired up. I care to some extent about, you know, it. I guess, I don't know, like if that it's mostly poor people it's happening to, does that make me, not really, I don't think I care. If it were all millionaire white guys, I would still be just as infuriated, but that's because I care about my priorities are slightly different than yours. Maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, do you care about the sexual Puritanism part of it?
Oh yeah, I started working on this because I first was interested in innocence, because through journalist Debbie Nathan, who was a friend, she introduced me to people who were falsely accused of child sexual abuse and wrongfully convicted. So I started working with this organization. I'm now on the board of it, the National Center for Reason and Justice. And I was really outraged by these stories of people who would be falsely accused of this crime. And there's a lot of wrongful convictions. If you look at the, there's a national exoneration database, and a whole category is child sexual abuse, because it's a crime that lends itself to wrongful convictions, because just pointing the finger at somebody and accusing them of a crime against a child, you know, often leads to a conviction, whether it's true or not. So when I met people who are wrongfully convicted of child sex abuse, I was immediately aware of like the stigma and horror surrounding these crimes, that even if people were innocent, people didn't want to get involved. The story of Bernard Baron, it always moved me to no end. He was a young working class white kid in Massachusetts who was working in a daycare center in the 80s. He was probably one of the first people convicted in the daycare panic. He was a gay teen, and some of the parents in the daycare center, he got the job through a job to help working class kids get jobs. He was a high school dropout, I think. Anyway, and it was a daycare center for working class people who were in the system in the city in Massachusetts. Anyway, two parents at the daycare center complained to the teacher, and they said, we don't want a gay man watching our son in the daycare center. And they said, well, we can't just fire him because he's gay. A couple of days later, they went and they said he was touching their son. He was quickly convicted at a trial and sentenced to 2 decades in prison. And in the 80s, the judge in the case said, putting a gay man in a daycare center is like putting a chocoholic in a candy store. And his crime went largely unnoticed by mainstream gay rights organizations because they didn't want to start defending somebody convicted of child sexual abuse because they'd just gotten, you know, some power. And it was it's very radioactive.
So GLAAD, G-L-A-A-D.
They didn't take the case.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good one, guys. Yeah. That's right. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So yeah. People like Debbie Nathan and my friend Bill Dobbs, who's a civil liberties attorney, heard about the case and eventually he got some support, and after about 20 years in prison, he was exonerated eventually. He died a few years ago. He was out like 7 or 8 years and then he died. And I met him and he spoke to my class and he was the most lovely person. And that's what motivated me initially to work on these cases. But then I started thinking, well, what if he had done it? How would we treat mm-hmm. him then? Like, what if he actually was guilty?
Right.
And then it led me to meet people who actually had committed crimes against children. And when I saw how they were treated and the price that they paid, it was so disproportionate to what they'd done that.
Yeah. I bet you've known a lot of gay men who had a sexual relationship with an adult when they were children. I sure do. I've met many gay men who have told me about this. That it was often, for a lot of gay men, I think this is true, that it was their first sexual encounter, their first sexual encounter with anyone was with an adult when they were children. And all the men I've known have talked about it, were very happy about it, right? It was not a bad thing at all. It was a good thing for them, including my uncle, by the way, mm-hmm. was one of them. But I've met many, many gay men who have said this to me.
And there's a lot written about that.
Actually talked to these guys who are the head of a very radical gay sex radical organization in Los Angeles, the Tom of Finland Foundation. It's about the gay pornographer who's big among gay men. Yeah. And the head of that foundation, Dirk Dehner, told mm-hmm. me this, that he had when he was like 14 or 15 or maybe younger, like an affair with a man who was like in his 30s, I think. And Dirk said to me, he looked at me in the eye and he said, and it was fantastic. And then I said, and there was a whole group of men around us when we were talking about this, all gay. And they all looked at me and started nodding and said, yep, me too. And I said, yeah, why do you not ever hear about this? Right. And they said, it's the thing. It's the secret we cannot tell among gays, because of course the stereotype, right. The negative stereotype of gay men has always been they're predators.
Right.
And they're out to get our children. So in part, the stereotype they were telling me is true. But then again, it's not necessarily bad, right? Because I think that a lot of gay men will tell you also that the adults who do that, who have sex with children, technically children, tend to, I think, identify the kids who are gay. And that's why they go for them. But
well, I think teenagers in general will reflect on relationships that they've had with people who are above the age of consent in positive ways, girls and boys.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's been some research showing that for young, particularly like before the internet, that for gay teenagers, finding older gay adult men was particularly helpful for them. I read a couple of articles about this because they were so isolated. So they would find somebody to help them understand what they were going through because they would be from communities where they couldn't express themselves. I feel like now with the internet, there's more outlets for people, but I think, yeah, talking about adolescent sexuality is really dangerous for everybody.
Sure,
right?
Is. But that's kind of at the core of this.
Right. That's right. I mean, like you, like for instance, saying an adult man who is, you know, preying in quotes on 14 and 15 year old girls, is he a pedophile? I mean, no. Yeah. And people will throw that word out. That word is so damaging and is such a terrible word. I wish I hadn't even said it. But people will just start saying that word and it isn't. I mean, they're below the age of consent. It's illegal, but is it a reality that 14 and 15 year olds have some sexual agency, are sexual, is something that you can't talk about or explore because you get accused. There is so much hysteria about this.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough one.
It is.
What do you think? It's a tough one. Because I used to do this in my classes all the time. I would bring this up. I'd go right to it.
Oh, wow.
When I was teaching American Studies at Barnard College, I'd be the male professor. Well, no,
right.
No, for me though, right? For Barnard, you know,
right.
Male professor in a classroom full of 19-year-old, 20-year-old young women, right? I would mm-hmm. say, hey, let's talk about the age of consent laws. Why 18? What's the magic in that moment when you turn 18 and you suddenly have agency and you didn't have agency the day before, you know? And it was really hard for a lot of them. And I had a couple of them walked out of my classes, and some of them were really into it and really passionate, but it was really, really tough. But you gotta have this discussion. For one thing, Europeans look at us like we're freaks because their age of consent laws are all much lower than ours. They're all 14, 15, 16, all across Europe and in much of the world. We're outliers, we're weirdos. We protect our children from sexuality from their own, here it is, from their own, am I right? Sexual agency more than anyone else does.
I would agree with that. Yes. But it's very, very difficult because the climate is it's so radioactive that you can't even talk about it. So people say my grandmother got married when she was 13. That's okay. But not my grandmother, my friend told me this, that her grandmother got married when she was 13. And it's pretty common, but today many of the people that, you know, I've interviewed, they're quote unquote victims were 16 years old. And they asked the judge, they would say, I had agency. I wanted to be with him. And it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case involving Zach Anderson, which got a huge amount of publicity of a kid who was 18. He met a girl online and she was underage. She lied and said she was 18, but it turned out she was really 14. But yeah, he had like a text exchange where she said, I'm 18. She identified herself as 18. He went and he had sex with her. They met like on Hot or Not website. And then he was sentenced to the sex offense registry, even though her mother said, my daughter lied. You know, he thought she was 18. She wanted to do this. His parents were really motivated and defended him very vigorously. And he's now been taken off of it, or he's about to be taken off of it. But that's because it got a huge amount. It was a national uproar. Mm-hmm. After I did that podcast about a week ago, the Tom Woods Show, mm-hmm. Somebody who was adjudicated at 14 emailed me and said, can you help me get off the registry? I'm on the registry in Florida. Do you have any advice for me? I was convicted at 14. What do I do?
So the easiest fix for this is to change the age of consent laws.
That would get rid of a lot of it. But I think the easiest fix right now is to get rid of the registry. I think that's really important. And
yeah, but you're still going to have people incarcerated.
We're going to still have people incarcerated. Right.
Things they shouldn't be incarcerated for.
Right. We have to figure out ways to dispel sex panic. And some people would say have sex education and prosecute people for having consensual sex, even if somebody's below the age of consent.
But it's within the global context, right? To say that we should lower the age of consent is a mainstream position. It's a totally mainstream position. It's even kind of conservative. Like I'm just talking about us looking like Europe.
Right. Right. Yes.
Right. That's all.
Right. Having a more honest relationship to sex and sexuality would be really important. But it is one of the hardest things I would say it's easier probably to get rid of the sex offense registry than to start implementing like good sex education and get rid of the age of consent.
Why do you start with sex education? Why can't we just lower the law?
Yeah. Or have some kind of rational
discussion about it.
Yeah.
So do you have a position on this? Now
you know what? I don't think that much about the age of consent. I think about the laws and the punishment and how we have to change those right now.
So even someone like you doesn't, you don't, it seems like you don't allow yourself to think about it, but it's such an,
I mean, there's been
thing.
Some, you know, it would be a start. I mean, I think obviously the age of consent, a lot of the cases that you look at, I think actually I was looking earlier just at some data. Hold on one second. And like in New York, 35% of the victims are 15 and older of people on the registry.
Exactly.
But yes, it's very hard. See, I like to find data and the age of consent would be very hard to.
There it is. Yeah. So if we became
in California,
all we have to do is become France or Spain, which is, I think the age of consent law is 14 and 15 there. Done. We finished. We fixed that.
Well, no, but like in some states, it's much lower. In California, about between 15 and 20% of victims are 15 and older. So there's a lot of people who do have victims that are younger. And look, the most common age of people who sexually offend against children is 14. So about, and that's not people on the registry. That's according to federal data on reports of child sexual abuse. So kids commit a lot of sex offenses against other kids because kids are with kids. It's really complicated. In some states, kids are on the registry.
What kid has not committed a sex offense? Seriously.
Right. No, I mean,
I mean, technically, right. I committed many sex offenses.
Lenore Scadese.
I never raped anybody, but I did a bunch of stuff when I was 12 or 13. Of course, I'm sure, you know, I don't know. I didn't do a lot, but I imagine I did some stuff that was probably technically illegal.
I think what's more helpful than thinking about the age of consent is what Lenore Scadese does, which is really brilliant, is when she gives talks about the registry, she asks a series of questions and people answer them anonymously. And it turns out that like a majority of every audience she speaks to has done something that could get them on the registry.
Exactly.
Yeah. She actually argues that your son is more likely to wind up on the sex offense registry than to be a victim of a sex offense.
Mm-hmm.
You have a child. Yes. You should worry more about them winding up on the registry than being a victim of a sex offense.
Yeah.
Statistically.
So there's about what? Four of us making these arguments?
Well, there's three, maybe 10 amazing national organizations
okay.
that are advocating for this. And then there's some local organizations. Last year, there were three national conferences. I mean, most people who meet somebody who's on the registry realizes very quickly how unfair it is. So people in these organizations, they're lawyers who defend people and see how insane it is. In New York, we have this amazing appellate organization that has a whole sex offense legal group. All they do is sex offense hearings. So it's lawyers are often involved in this and radicalized and like, oh my God, this is horrible. And family members of people on the registry, because people on the registry themselves can't do so much. Criminologists are really aware of this because there's been a lot written and there's been some really amazing journalism. A guy, Josh Vaughn, wrote a great piece in The Appeal a couple of days ago about the craziness of these laws.
So what should people do? Because we're starting a movement.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
When a politician or a local news station is like, oh my God, it's Halloween. Keep your kids in because the people on the registry are going to get them. They should be like, this is not a problem. They should not vote for politicians who pander to fears about sex offenses. They should, you know, let their kids play and be independent and not worry that people on sex offense registries are going to hurt their kids.
So abolish the sex offense registry.
Yes.
Okay. I agree with that. I also want to change the age of consent laws, but I'm happy, thrilled to start with attacking the sex offense registry. I want to get rid of that immediately.
Yes.
I think that is a red alert.
Yes.
People often talk about lives being destroyed, right? They use that too loosely because often it's not really people's lives are being destroyed by this or that policy. I mean, bad things happen, don't get me wrong, but they come back from it eventually. This actually really destroys lives.
Really destroys
they can't
lives.
Live in much of the country.
Right.
They can't get employment, right? They are discriminated against radically they can't even get into hurricane shelters when there's a hurricane,
That's
apparently.
Right. That's right.
You know, so This is code blue to me, and we got to do that. I'm totally with you. So what you should do, everyone, is read her book, read Emily's book, Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing Us. And then the organizations are called?
Well, there's three organizations. One organization that I'm on the board of is the Alliance for the Constitutional Reform of Sex Offense Laws, which is an amazing national organization that advocates and is trying to change these laws. And there's a group called Women Against the Registry. That's great. And lots
oh, really?
Of amazing organizations. Yeah.
Okay.
That started by a mother of a registrant who has seen what this has done to her son's life. And she's just become this amazing activist. There's local organizations in Texas. There's a group called Texas Voices run by Mary Sue Molnar, who's also a mother of a registrant.
Mm-hmm. David Feige's film.
Here's the thing.
This sort of speaks to the problem we're encountering. It's truly, you have to take my word for it. You've seen it and I've seen
it,
right? It's just on its own, just on in terms of documentary filmmaking. I think it's an excellent film
it's
on its own,
film.
Just as a film, right?
Right.
It's excellent, super smart, moving, but not manipulative at all.
Right.
And very nuanced in the way it's dealing with this, but devastating, a devastating critique of this thing,
right.
of the registry. It has not really, it has not been released.
Right. It's really hard to find it.
You can't get it.
Because,
and because, well, for a lot of, well, for
right.
these reasons, right? Because it's
right.
so taboo. And David said this to me when I interviewed him, right? It's just such a hard thing to put forward. But I do kind of feel like in 2 years ago, I could see the world turning around sex work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's
right.
what I think that's on its way. Like
I
really
so
think there's been a turn on sex work. We're mm-hmm. not there yet, but I think in our lifetime, sex work will be basically legal, decriminalized in our country.
Mm-hmm.
I do. Because I think if you look at the history of drugs, right, that's what happened. And it's amazing to think that now pot is legal in most states. Like if I'd said that 10 years ago, you would have been like, you're insane.
Right.
Sex work, I see it turning. And I think it certainly has not turned with this, but I think it's about to. Because I see now a core group of thinkers and activists like you and others who are really good on this and just making absolutely almost airtight arguments.
Good, I agree.
So you should everyone who's listening who wants to do something about it, the first thing to do is get David Feige to release his film. I don't even know what that requires, but get in touch with him and his production company and I don't know, demand that movie theaters show it or whatever. Read Emily Horowitz's book. And get in contact with these organizations, I actually think a movement could start.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking on this topic. You're really fearless to even address this. So
thank you. Well, so are you. And you know, you live in New York. I no longer live here, so I don't have to worry about it too much. But although I live in Oregon, which is in some ways even worse, you know, frying pan into the fire, at least on this topic. Professor Emily Horowitz, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. To purchase any of the Renegade University video courses, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses.